Welcome to the Resume Storyteller, bringing you interviews with industry experts, regular folks who tested the job search waters and succeeded, and strategies to tell your story and land you job interviews. Here's your host, Virginia Franco.
I have with me today Matt Tucker, who is a career counselor for senior executives and the president of Next Chapter Career Transitions. After 20 years in senior manager roles with Fortune 500s, including GE Capital and HSBC, he made a pivot to become a senior manager with a tech startup. These experiences provided him with a unique perspective on what makes a great hire and the best ways to articulate your value proposition. So as the founder of Next Chapter Career Transitions, a career counseling company focused on helping candidates navigate the confusing and frustrating process of finding a job, he leverages his executive hiring experiences to help clients to create actionable job search plans and really help them land their dream jobs. So Matt, thank you so much for joining me. As I was telling you earlier before I hit record, I'm a huge fan of what you're putting out there on LinkedIn, and you're giving really great advice to job seekers.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to be here, and anytime I can add value, out there to the group, I welcome the opportunity.
So you heard me give a quick overview of your earlier career, but what did you decide to pivot into helping executives?
Yeah, so, as you mentioned, I had a, pretty extensive career with Fortune 500 companies and startups. And, in those roles, I spent an awful lot of time interviewing potential hires, reviewing resumes, and just, had a firsthand look at what, people were doing right, some of the pitfalls of what, candidates were falling into, and some of the things
the do's and don'ts.
Yeah, some of the do's and don'ts. And I really had a firsthand look at it. And so after my last role, I thought that it was just a natural transition to, try to put that 30 years of experience to use trying to help people. And so that was really the motivating factor of why I decided to go out on my own and create my own company and see if I couldn't help people, get the roles that they were looking for.
Given that you're working with people that have been in the job force for a very long time, are there sort of some common things that you see are catching your executive job search clients off guard?
Yeah, there are typically a couple of things that I find that always surprise them. First of all, it's the time to land the next role. I think sometimes they think it's, you hear about the great resignation and everyone, getting new roles and, new jobs, but it does take time. And unless you're in a, one of the supercharged tech roles, it takes time to get that next position, especially if it's, a really good role and one that you're really going to enjoy. So that's the first.
And there's been, I've seen where people will say, as a rule of thumb, based on X years of experience, expect it to take X amount of time. And I know that varies. Certainly in tech, it's a different beast. But what do you give people a rule of thumb or, a roadmap for how long you should expect it to take?
The old rule of thumb, I think of, 1 month for every 10,000 is is probably it's just a variable that it's very hard to say. I was working with a client who's coming off of a 30-year career, got laid off unexpectedly, and she's 63 years old. She could be in for a long that could be a long. So I tell my clients, expect it to take months and expect it to take several months. But if it doesn't take that long, consider yourself fortunate.
Sort of prepare for the worst and
correct.
You ready for that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I agree with that. And you're right. The older you are, the longer it does seem to take. And there's studies that back that up. Once you hit, I think it's over 55, that the length of time can grow up dramatically for lots of different reasons.
Exactly.
Are there any other things that are really surprising your clients that caught them off guard, aside from just the sheer length of time that it takes?
The number of interviews that they have to go through. I think that, you know, the days of going in and, you know, meeting with HR and meeting with a hiring manager and one other person, I think those days are gone. You know, I advise my clients, be prepared for 4 to 6 interviews, and be prepared. It could take a couple of weeks, several weeks, to get through that process. I think that, you know, I think that there is something out there right now where companies feel like there is strength in numbers, and somehow the more people that they have interview someone and ask the same question, the better it is.
I call it death by consensus. And I have, and I'm sure you saw it on the hiring side, but as a writer, I saw it certainly during the recession, definitely during the pandemic, when everything's getting a little shaky, people are more nervous about making a decision without bringing extra people in to confirm and back up the process.
You know what? That is exactly right. And, you know, candidly, I don't know that it's helpful at a certain point. And I think one of the things that happens is that the candidate just gets frustrated. And in a market like this, I'm not saying that you have to move, you know, at the speed of sound to get, you know, someone through the process, but people are going to be getting offers. And so if you really want to get the position filled, get the people lined up to interview them, get it done. And if you want to make an offer, make an offer.
Don't fool around with the back and forth. I agree with that. I have seen since COVID, I saw it get really bad. One of my clients had 9 rounds of interviews. And I kept saying, are you sure you don't want to just drop out? And he's like, no, at this point, I'm just going to see it through. But I have seen, not across the board, but instances where companies are cutting to the chase a little bit more quickly. Thank the Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, there's just a, now I think that there's a common, you know, kind of perception out there that really good candidates are going to get multiple offers. So if someone falls in your lap and they are really good, you need to move quickly.
I agree. No, that's a good thing for job seekers. So I'd love to pivot a little bit to the parts of the hiring process that are within our control. And one of those is getting a sense for a company's culture, because you do have a couple of offers that you are weighing, and understanding the company, you know, a company's culture is part of what the decision-making process for you, that what you're weighing. And I remember that you talked on LinkedIn about how the company's onboarding process speaks volumes about their culture. I'd love if you could sort of elaborate on that and maybe share a few ways that job seekers can, you know, uncover some of that intel, find out exactly what an onboarding process is like once you're hired.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think sometimes, you know, people get confused between onboarding and orientation. So
orientation. Oh, I'm confused. Tell me the difference. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, to me, orientation is you fill out a lot of HR paperwork, benefit information, you hand it in. They show you where, you know, you can go get lunch and, you know, you're kind of done. Onboarding, and I need to qualify this by saying really good onboarding, is a process that can take weeks, if not months. It's onboarding, you know, to me is an introduction into, you know, the culture of the company, the processes, the performance expectations. It's way more than a handful of paperwork. It's hopefully getting assigned, you know, a mentor, or a peer, you know, someone who is, you know, going to help you get acclimated and get ramped up more quickly. It's really an opportunity to learn about the company's philosophy and, you know, and what they're all about. What's there for career development? You know, just a really in-depth knowledge of the role, the decision makers, the organizational chart, and so on.
All the things that you need to do, you need to be able to do your job optimally, right?
Exactly. And I think at some point I came across some data that, you know, companies that have really good onboarding processes, their retention rate for new employees is significantly higher than those companies who do not. So I think that, you know, it's pretty well documented that just, you know, throwing a new employee into the fire is just not a productive way of introducing them to the company.
That's interesting. Does that go for startup environments? Because I feel like that is a wild west, and I imagine that onboarding wouldn't happen, right? Because everyone's sort of piecing it together.
Yeah, let me tell you, going from a Fortune 500 company to a startup.
Oh, right, you've done both.
That was a pivot. Let me tell you, and you know, you go from an organization that is, you know, highly structured to one where you're herding cats. I mean, it's just crazy.
Right. And some people love that.
I'm sorry?
Some people love that environment. They prefer it to the structure.
You know, I'm thrilled, you know, that I did it. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of work. It was very rewarding. You get to make a lot of decisions very, very quickly, and you learn from your mistakes and you move on. But even, you know, even the startup that I was at, we did have, I think it was a decent onboarding process. You know, it was a lot of salespeople, and there was a certain camaraderie amongst them, and they helped each other out. And we were fortunate that we did have a corporate trainer. So new employees got a pretty good lay of the land. They got a lot of feedback, a lot of one-on-ones. So it was,
well,
it was
that collaborative support in and of itself provides onboarding, right? You're learning together.
Exactly. There was a real team mentality. Multiple, you know, account executives were brought on at the same time. And so they really, you know, they became very, very close knit. And it was really neat. It worked well.
So what kinds of questions can people ask to uncover onboarding details?
I think that one of the things that I tell my clients to do is when they're going through the interview process, ask what does the job look like and what can I expect over the next 30, 60, 90 days? What kind of support is in place to get me ramped up quickly? And I think it's important to be consistent about asking that question to everyone you speak to. Yeah. Knowing that you're going to be talking to multiple people, you definitely want to see and kind of compare what their answers come out like. If they're all kind of, you know, singing the same tune, that's great. If they're, you know, kind of all over the board, then you kind of have to wonder, you know, is there consistency? And then the other thing that I tell my folks is talk to former employees. They can really give you the lay of the land, and sometimes they feel a little bit more open about discussing what you know, the onboarding process is.
Yeah,
really,
they feel more free. Yeah. And I don't know if you agree with this, but I've always felt like everyone will always have unique opinions, some more strong than others. But if three or five people say the same thing, positive or negative, then you have a thread that you should consider.
You're absolutely right. You need to look for a trend in the feedback. And hopefully it's a great trend and it makes you feel good about the role. Right. But if it's not, then it's a red flag and you may have to dig a little bit deeper.
Yeah, I agree with that. I like the looking for feedback trends. That makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
And this is sort of a separate topic, but I know, I'm sure that you work with executives who have always approached job search. Have viewed job search as something that is a private matter. And maybe aside from connecting with recruiters that they've known for years, they really are at a loss for how to get started. Can you give some suggestions for people that cringe at the idea of a public job search? I know that I work with those people quite a bit.
Yeah, it's tough because it's almost counterintuitive. You are out there and you're looking for a new role, but you're trying to keep it private. What I suggest, and I think that this does make it a little bit more challenging for some, is you need to be able to share with your friends, your family, and your close confidants that you are out there looking. You don't have to plaster it all over LinkedIn, social media, whatever the case may be. But if you have a good network and you have trusted confidants within that network, I think that there's a huge benefit of letting them know, A, that you're out there looking, and B, specifically what it is that you're looking for. Because your friends, your family, your close confidants, those are going to be the people that know you best and
motivated, right?
Yeah, more willing to help you.
And I think I love the point you brought up. It doesn't need to be blasted all over social media. That is not everyone's cup of tea. And there's a big difference between a public job search can mean talking to your confidants versus spraying it across Facebook and LinkedIn.
Exactly. At some point, you need to tell people that you are out there looking. Otherwise, it can get pretty lonely, and job boards are not the way to go.
No, they're not, especially once you get to that more executive level. Exactly. And I love that you brought up the importance of not just saying, "Hey, I'm looking," but being really clear on what you're looking for, because people in your inner circle are motivated to want to help you. And the more specific you can be, the greater you make it that much easier for them to be able to connect you with people and help you to consider new opportunities.
You're exactly right. And if you ask for help, they want to help you.
I agree. The other thing I always tell my executive clients is, just by virtue of us being older, we have hopefully a larger group of friends, family, and close confidants, and certainly colleagues. And so that makes that circle of who you feel comfortable sharing things with greater, which I think is an advantage over someone who's maybe only been working for a couple of years.
Yeah, that's really true. And I think, to your point, if it's a C-level role that you're in, or that you are, that's your area of expertise, then typically people at that level, they're pretty dialed into, opportunities that are out there because they've been approached by recruiters.
Yeah.
So I think when you get up there, whether it be a CEO or, chief revenue officer, whatever the case may be, they're a little bit more dialed in, and they can appreciate there are only so many seats at the top, and they may
That's
be
right.
very willing to help.
That's very true. That's a great point. The other thing that I read that you have you've written about is the importance of getting on a company's radar. What tips do you have for doing this? And I'm curious to hear if you feel like the approach for getting on a company's radar should differ based on if we're talking a big Fortune 500 or a small private equity backed company.
Sure, that's a great question. So in terms of getting on a company's radar, you know, first and foremost, I think you want to identify the companies that you want to work for. You know, pick 10 to 15 companies that you think would be a good match for you. And then what I always suggest is follow that company on LinkedIn. Get tuned into what's going on at that company. See if they're in the news. Did they just raise, did they just raise equity? Did they, you know, whatever the case may be. And then I tell my folks, engage with what could or who could be your potential peers there. Engage with their posts, like their posts, comment with their posts, and try to develop a relationship, on LinkedIn. And also, LinkedIn is, you know, pretty favorable to letting you do this. Do a search of who could be potential hiring managers there. And then
search filters are amazing for that.
And then follow them, engage with them, strike up a dialogue, ask questions, whether it be potential peers or potential hiring managers. Ask questions about what's going on there. Why do you like it there? Always try to, you know, just go in. Don't go in, you know, like a ton of bricks. Hey, I'm looking for a job. You know, right. Develop that relationship first. And with other scenarios, also engage with former employees. Especially ones who had been there recently, they can help you understand the organizational chart there and steer you in the right direction. But I think ultimately, once you strike up a relationship with the right people there, then I recommend, you know, ask for an informational interview. Or if you see that there's a posting online for a job that you know, falls into your area of expertise, I don't hesitate to say, go directly to the hiring manager and say, hey, I saw this. I think that I can add value. Can we get together?
I agree with that. I don't recall who I was speaking with. I think it might have been Liam Darmody. I don't know if you know him or not, but he was speaking about what you were just saying about striking up dialogues, engaging with people that are your peers by liking and commenting on their posts. And one of the things that he said was that with some of the larger companies, there's more restrictions around the kinds of engagement you can do on LinkedIn. And people are less apt to have social media conversations than they are in smaller companies or privately held companies. And I know that depends on the industry and how regulated it is, how often that happens. But he felt like some of those conversations with some of the more regulated companies might need to happen through emails versus through socials. What do you think about that?
Well, obviously, if you're on social media, everybody can see what's going on. There's no doubt about it. There's no secret. So I think that people are a little bit more guarded. I think that email, certainly at some of the larger companies and, as to your point, the more regulated companies can be more effective. And if you can use an app like MailScoop or something like that, to kind of nail down and, you know, an email address of someone who you want to get in touch with, I think that can be effective. You really have to feel out the culture of the company that you're dealing with.
That's a really good point. Yeah. And you can tell by looking at, you can look at people's activity levels on LinkedIn and see how engaged they are. And if you see that that is commonplace within the company or not, that tells you, it gives you a sense of how restrictive it is. I know here in Charlotte, where I live, you know, a couple of the banks, you're really not supposed to be doing a whole lot. You're not allowed to have recommendations. There's all sorts of rules and regulations, and so a lot of people just stay away from it. But that isn't the case with other kinds of companies. So you just have to sort of.
Yeah, I think sometimes you just water and you find out pretty quickly which way. But that's a great point.
But I love the idea of identifying. You can still use LinkedIn to identify those people, and then you can determine how to strike up those dialogues.
Exactly.
Based on that. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I asked for 3 tips, and I think you gave me 6. So thank you very much.
I'm in 6.
I love that. So you and I have both shared frustration in our posts, which is probably how you got on my radar, on the myth that, you know, if I build a resume or I have a great LinkedIn, they will come. And it sounds like we both agree that a great resume in LinkedIn is not a magic bullet. I wish it was. If it was, I would charge a lot more. When it comes to the resume, though, what would you say are sort of the best first steps to make sure it gets seen by the right people?
So I think that the number one first step is determine who the right people are.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
You need to find out who the right people are. And, you know, the one thing that you don't want to do is shotgun your resume all over an organization. It just doesn't help. The best thing to do, and again, you can, there are so many search features if you drill down on LinkedIn where you can find out, you know, based on title, obviously based on company, you know, what people do, that you can help to narrow that down. And also if you've done your research and you've formed some relationships with folks at the company, they can direct you in the right direction. So, It's about doing your research. And then I'm a little bit careful about, you know, recommending that you send your resume immediately off to a hiring manager because you don't want to be off-putting. It's best if you can get a little bit of a relationship going first.
A relationship, yeah.
Yeah. You know, but on the other hand, if it's a hot position and it's one that a hiring manager really wants to get filled, I know from my experience, if I got a really great resume sent to me directly in an email, I gave that person credit for tracking down my email and, you know, contact information, and I looked at it. So getting to the right,
show that extra little bit of initiative.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I read sometimes where, you know, folks say, well, you know, direct engagement isn't such a great idea. I just felt that in the roles where I was, you know, I was always hiring and I was always looking for good people. If you could show a little bit of initiative, especially when I was hiring for a sales position, well, that's what I want.
That's right. You want the extra mile to try to break down that barrier and get through to the decision maker.
Exactly. Exactly.
What about ways to get traffic to your LinkedIn site?
So I think that one of the things that I think LinkedIn rewards is consistent activity. If you are consistently commenting on posts that kind of fall within your ecosystem, if you're liking, you're commenting, you're adding value, you are going to end up winning. And I think that's before you even get to the point where you are posting your own content.
Right. There's so much power in just comments.
Exactly. I think that the key is, you know, engage with people who, like I said, are in the same ecosystem as you. Be professional, avoid politics, and just be really genuine. Okay. And then, you know, if you're a little bit new to it, go ahead and start posting a couple times a week. I know that a lot of people, you know, it makes them nervous. They're afraid that, you know, their posts aren't going to be good, you know, and on and on and on. Just get started.
That's what I love practicing. To me, practicing with comments, it's a great way to start testing the water and get used to your sharing your own voice, it gives you confidence to build your own content from there.
Exactly. And, you know, and typically what I've found is that if you comment on a post, the original poster is typically going to come back around and say, hey, thanks. You know what? Mm-hmm. That was a point. I appreciate that. And it kind of, you know, it gives you a little bit more confidence to go on and post something on your own. And I think, you know, getting back to my original point, if you're consistent, if you're always looking at ways to add value, then you're just naturally, over time, you're going to drive more activity towards your post. You're going to have more engagement. You're going to get more connections. And I think activity just begets more activity.
No, I agree with that. For years now, I take the months of June and July where I don't post anything new. I just comment, but I stick around for the comments. And I consistently continue to get a really good number of quality connection requests just from that. And you're right, LinkedIn rewards that activity. It's one of the, how you engage is one of the factors in its algorithm. I don't know exactly what factor, but it is a factor. And you will show up more in feeds of others.
Yeah, exactly.
The way the algorithm works. Yeah.
Yeah. And you could go crazy trying to figure out the algorithm. And fortunately on LinkedIn, there are people that's what they do.
That's right. That's why we follow them.
Which is why I follow them. But I think that one of the things that I always, recommend to my clients is if you only have 100 connections, you need to get aggressive about engaging with people, you know, in your area and expanding your network. Because in my world, if you're under 500 connections, your reach is probably a little bit limited.
I agree with that. And I think that that 500 number, I don't know if it's still 500, but it used to be that was the tipping point to start. And it impacts, the more connections you have, I believe it's one of the other factors that impacts how high up you show in searches as well. But you know, LinkedIn's like a needy girlfriend. They want you to be connecting. They want you to be engaged. They want you to be on the site.
It can be exhausting, but it doesn't have to be.
No, you're right.
Yeah,
you're right. How much time do you recommend people spend every day to get started?
Boy, you know, I think that, again, it depends upon whether or not you're working full-time or you're full-time looking for work. I think that, you know, if your full-time job is looking for a job, then I think you can easily spend, you know, 2 or 3 hours utilizing LinkedIn. And that might be, you know, that might be a little bit low, but I think that there is so much there to offer. And I think that you're much more likely to find a connection on LinkedIn who will help you find your next job than spending that 2 or 3 hours on job boards shotgunning your. So I think that you need to look at where is your best ROI. And I think it's on. I do.
I agree with that. And you could spend, I mean, there's hours that you can spend blocks of time using LinkedIn for research, again, to identify people and companies and all of that. And then you could spend 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night engaging in content. And that can be done, you know, in smaller slivers of time, depending on how your day is, how busy you are during the day.
100%. It's 100%.
Ways you can do that.
Yeah. It seems like between 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning, LinkedIn is just on fire, at least in the people that I follow.
That's what I think the East Coast people, I don't know about West Coast people, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The whole slew later in the day. So perform or hiring, I'd love to get a sense for how important you feel like referrals and recommendations are during an executive job search. You know, it used to be way back in the day where you would say referrals available upon request. Now we have LinkedIn recommendations. How much did you value those when you were hiring?
Well, if I understand your question, are you talking about if a employee referred someone to me for an open position, that type of referral?
I guess both. Internal referrals and then vetting people through their referral, where they say, here are a list of referrals.
Yeah. People. So, well, just in terms of internal referrals, those are gold. If you can get an internal referral, an internal referral to me, especially if it was from someone who was a high performer, that resume got read and more than likely got a phone call, because really good people like to be surrounded by good people.
Yeah.
I think referrals, it's what you make of them and what you do with them once you get them. Recommendations and referrals, I think you kind of have to sift through them. If you're talking to, one of them, kind of dig down and make sure that you are, if they're referring someone for a position, that is open, find out, what do you know about the person who you're referring? What can you tell me about them? Pros and cons, that type of thing. I think you need to drill down in that particular.
In terms of, since you did mostly hire for sales, what's your sense of what percentage of people you brought on that came to you as a result of a referral?
So initially, it was a very high number. We had a very, very good internal referral reward program. So we incented our employees to, bring in candidates. And so initially it worked very, very well. I can't give you a particular percentage, but I can tell you that the percentage of people that were referred that got hired was pretty high. Yeah. One of the challenges in if you're not from the Northeast, you wouldn't know this, but the startup that I worked at was in Newport, Rhode Island, which is an island. And there are only so many people who live in Newport, Rhode Island. So
right.
As the years went on, it was a little bit harder to get recommendations and get referrals. But it's the best way to get your resume in front of a hiring manager, bar none.
I agree with that. And you bring up a good point about the geographics. Now that we are going more virtual, that might be changing. Networking is a little different when you are targeting working in a specific city or area, especially if it's a smaller, if it's a harder to access area. But to me, it's just human nature that people, even if you have to go through the process of creating a posting or working with an internal recruiter, with a recruiter, you want to reach out and say, hey, think about who you know and ask people who they know. And so it makes sense why internal referrals are gold.
Yeah, it makes so much sense because number one, if I'm referring someone, well, I don't want to refer someone who is not a great worker, who
reflects poorly on you, right?
Yeah, it's a reflection on me. And I think, as I mentioned, top performers like to be surrounded by top performers. So whoever sends that referral, whoever gives that referral matters. And I think just from a cost perspective, I think it's short-sighted if companies don't incent well for employee referrals, because it's the smart way to go.
That makes total sense. I would love to sort of pivot here and ask you about age discrimination, because you and I both work with executives, which means we are talking about people that have many years of experience under their belt, 20, 25, 30 or more. And I know a lot of people that worry about it. How do you advise your clients to sort of navigate this?
Well, age discrimination is one of my pet peeves. It's maddening that somehow or other you're less likely to get hired because you have more experience. It's just counterintuitive. That being said, you know, you can't change your age. You just can't. Eventually, they're going to find out how old you are. Yeah. If you have a Zoom call or a face to face, but the key is to get to that point. And I think that this is where it's really, really important that you're strategic in the content in your resume, and you are strategic about the content in your LinkedIn profile. And little things matter. I always counsel my clients that you have to remove graduation dates. That, yeah, I know you probably had a great, job 30 years ago where you accomplished a lot, but you might want to drop that from the resume and focus on your really big wins and big accomplishments in the last 15 years, maybe 20 years. Make sure that your technology is up to date on the resume. Microsoft Word and Lotus Notes are not technologies that are going to get noticed in a good way. So make sure that you're eliminating red flags right out of the gate that eliminate you from consideration before you even have a chance to get to the next step.
That's along the lines of what I advise. I've always said, I want my clients to be as timeless as possible on paper, so that they are, because even if there's not age discrimination, what I have seen happen when people start seeing older stuff is that, I mean, readers go into a rabbit hole where they go, oh, I wonder if he does blah, blah, blah. I went to school, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if he has kids. Like, it's all sort of side nonsense enters people's brains that detracts from the point of reading the resume, which is to show your value. And doing what you said, focusing on the last 15, 20 years, eliminating things when you went to school, getting rid of your AOL email and your Lotus Notes, those sorts of things eliminate. It mitigates chance that the reader is going to go into that rabbit hole, and no one will know if you're, 35 or 65.
Exactly.
Hopefully be compelled to want to bring you in.
Yeah. And I think that, if you do break it down to the last 15 years and you can really focus on important data points, you can, just something that, strikes the reader right between the eyes and is quantifiable, then in the real world, you would hope that that is really what matters.
And I think it does. I mean, I've worked with people that land of all ages. It's all about keeping control of what you can control, and presenting yourself on paper in a way that makes you timeless is valuable. Because the other thing I have seen, and I don't know if you agree with this, but that just the fact that you have 30 years of experience isn't enough to impress someone. You need to show them what you've done with that.
I totally agree with that. Time on the job does not necessarily equate to productivity. And when you don't, my philosophy is don't make people guess. Hit them with the numbers and let them read it for themselves. That's, I think, is the key.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we are about to approach the holiday, or I guess we are in the holiday season. Let's say you go to your a holiday party and someone comes up to you, finds out what you do for a living and asks you, what are one or two tools that a job seeker or career changer needs to have as they get ready to hunt next year? What would you say to that?
I think, you know, if I were to say, and this is probably not a conventional tool, but if I were to say the one tool that is going to help you the most in your, you know, career journey, have a great network.
Yeah. It carries you so far.
Yeah. And I don't say have a great network just so that you can fall back on it when you're looking for a job or you're looking for a new role. You know, it's been my experience. If you have a great network, you know, these are people who you can talk to, who you can share things with, who, you know what, when you hit a bump in the road, there are people that will support you. You know, a career is a long journey and it's impossible to go through it alone. So if you have a strong network, I think that that is just the number one thing that you know, you can share the good times with, and they can help to pump you up when you hit that bump in the road.
No, and especially during job search, it can be very lonely. It's usually, I rarely see job searches. They don't have some ups. You know, they always have ups, but they certainly have some downs, and having people in your corner to get you through that, it can make all the difference.
Exactly. I agree 100%. Yep.
So you have been very busy this year, and we are getting ready to start looking at 2022. What are your plans for next year? What's next?
You know, for me, I really want to just continue to refine, you know, my skill set. I love helping people. That's why I do this. And so going into 2022, if I can figure out new ways to add value to the folks that I work with, you know, for me, that's a huge win. I want people to be successful. I've had to look for a job. It can be tough. It can be scary. It's, you know, it can be not a lot of fun. And so if I can help people get through that, you know, faster with less pain, and find a job that they really, really love, you know, for me, that is really what it's all about.
Yeah, there is nothing more rewarding. I appreciate that. So if people want to get in touch with you, I have shared your LinkedIn and your email. Are those the two best places to connect with you?
Absolutely. Yep.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for this. I love what you shared today. I love what you share on LinkedIn. So please go follow him. And thank you.
Virginia, I really appreciate the opportunity to be on the podcast. And I hope you have a wonderful holiday.
You've been listening to The Resume Storyteller with Virginia Franco. To learn more about storytelling strategies to catch the eye of today's online CM hiring and decision makers, please visit www.virginiafrancoresumes.com.